It's the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack, in for Faith. This show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Navigating our healthcare system is frustrating and time-consuming enough when you're healthy. But what if you get a serious diagnosis? You'll probably have to deal with multiple doctor's offices and their front desk staffs, a hospital or clinic that may not be familiar, and a sudden deluge of paperwork, phone calls, and appointments. The chances for confusion and miscommunication multiply all along the chain, and this can lead to problems ranging from annoying clerical mistakes to serious medical errors, which is why my guest, Leslie Michelson, is on a mission to empower the patient. Michelson is the founder and CEO of Private Health Management. He's a medical case management expert and has been involved in almost all aspects of the healthcare system. He's founded and led four entrepreneurial healthcare companies focused on improving quality of care. And he's the author of the book we're talking about today called The Patient's Playbook, How to Save Your Life and the Lives of Those You Love. He lives in Los Angeles and joins us today by phone from New York. Leslie Michelson, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Lori. It's nice to be on with you.
Nice to have you. You have a company, as I mentioned in the introduction, called Private Health Management. So you're basically in the business of patient advocacy. We had started a conversation off air, which was fascinating, about how you got started in this. And you said in the beginning, this wasn't even a business for you.
No, it was only very recently become a business. You know, it actually started, I kind of started my career when I was a 17-year-old in high school in suburban New Jersey, when my father came home one night and looked very sad and depressed. His cardiologist had told him he needed open heart surgery. I didn't even know what that was, but it scared me half to death. I couldn't sleep that night. The next day I got home from school. I was kind of an assertive guy. I got home, I dialed Lenox Hill Hospital in New York. We lived in suburban New Jersey. It was the only hospital I knew. Asked for the chairman of cardiology, made an appointment for my father to get a second opinion. When my father came back from the second opinion, I was waiting with bated breath, to say the least. And when he got home, he said, the doctor in New York said, there's nothing wrong with my heart. I don't need the surgery. And the doctor who was recommending it should be shot in the public square. My dad didn't have the surgery. He lived 40 more years, never had any heart problems. I got four decades out of him. And he developed strong and wonderful relationships with my wife and my two precious daughters over that period and did amazing things with his life. So when something like that happens to you, it changes your life.
Leslie, why did you want to write this book?
Well, after that, when I shifted my career to running healthcare companies, my phone would ring with people with tough medical issues, and I would help them gratis, at night, on the weekends, during lunch, interstitially during the day. And what I learned is that I could actually help people, and word circulated, if you're sick, call Leslie. He'll help. And I ended up having, I could take a maximum of about 15 patients at a time, and I ended up with a waiting list of 20 to 30 patients. So I said, it's time to build one more business to see if we can do this on a larger scale, because there's more people who need this help than I can provide. Now, my company, Private Health, is expensive. We cater to people who have means, but it's always rubbed me that we weren't able to help people who couldn't afford us. So I've spent the past 2.5 years distilling down everything I've learned from helping thousands of people over 30 years so that everybody could get the benefit of that guidance.
You say that in 1999, an Institute of Medicine report titled To Err is Human revealed that our system can be extremely harmful to our health. It was estimated that at least 44,000 and up to 98,000 people in the United States were dying every year as a result of medical error.
Those are shattering statistics, and it's actually even worse. The latest data suggests that we lose 400,000 people each and every year from preventable medical errors. It's the third leading cause of death in the United States, right behind heart disease and cancer. And to put it in context, Lori, it's the equivalent of two fully loaded jumbo jets crashing with no survivors every single day of the year. What's important about that is if you follow the guidance that I've developed over the years, you can make sure that neither you nor your loved ones becomes one of those statistics.
What are some of those errors?
a lot of it relates to inaccurate, delayed, or incomplete diagnoses. Others involve surgeries that people didn't need or surgeries performed by physicians who didn't have the requisite expertise, or lack of communication, a physician not knowing that you're allergic to penicillin and giving you the drug. There's every time I think about this, there's one case that comes to mind that absolutely haunts me. It was an executive in Philadelphia whose elderly mother, who was in her late 80s, had esophageal cancer and needed a very technical and complex surgery. And this guy worked in downtown Philadelphia, and he elected to have his mom have the surgery in a small community hospital in suburban Philadelphia. And it's not a surgery that hospital should have been doing because it was so technically complex and they didn't have the experience in doing it. Well, his wonderful mother developed a complication that they couldn't manage, and she ultimately became brain dead and passed away. And it never occurred to this guy, who loved his mother, that what he needed to do is take her downtown with him one day and go to the University of Pennsylvania Hospital, which is one of the best in the world for this kind of procedure. And maybe, you never know for sure, but maybe his mom would still be alive today. You know, that's the sort of thing that, you know, can change the whole course of a family's history.
And we're going to get into more about how to look for specialists and getting second opinions. How do you think the Affordable Care Act has influenced patient safety?
Well, it's very complicated legislation. There are lots of pros and cons with respect to it. But whatever the regulators and the insurance companies do with respect to insurance, it just becomes more and more important for each individual to learn how to become a proactive medical consumer, partnering with their physicians, understanding their disease, and making more informed choices.
And you say that all starts with your primary care physician, and that forging a strong partnership with a caring and committed PCP is one of the most important first steps you can take. How do we start that process?
Well, some people are daunted by it, and I can certainly understand that. It can be intimidating to think about selecting physicians and interviewing them the way we do with lawyers or babysitters or preschools for our kids. But, you know, we tell the story in the book of Haley, who's a new mom in her early 40s, who wanted to find a new primary care physician. And she went through the three steps that I kind of teach everybody that they can do. Step one is make a list of the things that you think are important in a physician, because you know. Step two is get referrals from your friends, from other physicians, from people who you trust, and see who they like. And then step three, which everyone thinks is hard to do but I know you can do, is make appointments to interview the physicians. Interview at least a few of them, ask them questions, listen to the results, and then trust your gut and you'll make a good choice.
I'm talking with Leslie Michelson. He's a medical case management expert and advocate for patient education, and we're talking about his book, The Patient's Playbook, about how to get the best possible medical care. Leslie, how do you judge whether or not you have a good primary care doctor?
Well, there are certain things that you need to look at. First is that you have a good interpersonal relationship so that they listen to you and you listen to them. Second, their office needs to be organized. About 8% of all findings that are problematic are never reported to patients because of the chaos of the healthcare delivery system. And that happens a lot at the internal medicine practice because so much of it is information passing back and forth. Third, that physician needs to be actively involved in helping you identify specialists if you have a significant issue that they can't manage. They need to support those specialists and provide coordination across everything that's going on with you because, after all, you're a single human being. And last, they need to support you in your wellness goals. There are things that everybody can do in terms of exercise, diet, managing stress, preventive things that every physician should be able to guide you on. And it's important for you to know that you've got a physician who will support you with that.
Is that difficult these days, particularly when internists don't really have the luxury of giving you much of their attention?
You know, it's not easy, but just about everybody can do it. It takes some effort. It requires a commitment, but the returns are enormous. because your primary care physician should be your quarterback. Let me give you an example. We talk about it in the book of Jennifer. Jennifer is a 55-year-old lawyer who is having all sorts of pains. She was fatigued. Her joints were hurting. It was her shoulder. Then it was her knee. And her primary care physician had sent her to a couple of physicians and basically kind of dismissed it as, it's all in your head. And, you know, women all too often hear that. It's not in your head. It's in your body. And you know that. And it turned out that she actually had a very serious condition called psoriatic arthritis. And it should have been diagnosed decades earlier, but her primary care physician hadn't given her the management and the intention, hadn't respected the way in which she was describing her symptoms enough to figure out what that diagnosis was. And as a result of that, she's had to go through a lot of treatment that perhaps could have been avoided.
So if you're someone like Jennifer, who has consistent pain, which she did, what should you be doing at that point?
Well, you need to make the decision to change doctors until you find someone who's actually going to listen to you and engage with you in a respectful way, in a progressive way, to get to the bottom of what's going on and get you a definitive diagnosis and the proper treatment. And for a condition like that, what that means is getting to the right experts. So where Jennifer is right now is a terrific place. It's just, it would have been better had it occurred some decades ago. She has a terrific rheumatologist who's caring and empathetic and manages all of her symptoms adroitly and listens to her and supports her. And she has one of the world's experts on her disease, Dr. Philip Meese, up in Washington State, who does telephone consultations with her so that he's making sure that she's getting the very best of the latest treatments and technologies for her condition. So she's now found the right balance, and everyone needs to work until they've done that.
You make a point, because so far we've heard that your company, Private Health Management, is not affordable for everybody, and we've heard the word experts, and that immediately makes people think good health care is for wealthy people. And you go out of your way to point out that that's not the case.
You know, it is a common thought that the very best health care is reserved for the wealthiest of people. But I've been brought in by some of the wealthiest people in the United States, in the world. And when I see the care that they've gotten before they come in, it's no better than the care that regular people are getting. The very best medical care goes to the savviest consumers. Almost all of the major hospitals, major academic centers in the major cities take Medicare and take most of the insurances. So the staff physicians there, who are in many respects some of the best in the world, can be available to you without any incremental cost because they're going to be in network. And so you can go see Peter Scardino at Memorial Sloan Kettering, the chairman of surgery, one of the major cancer centers, probably, you know, the best prostate cancer surgeon in the world, one of the most well-respected, and he takes almost all insurances. So if you unfortunately are diagnosed with prostate cancer and you need surgery and you're in New York and you have insurance, you can call Dr. Scardino's office and get an appointment and have it not cost any more because he's in network.
I'm talking with Leslie Michelson. He's a medical case management expert and advocate for patient education. And we're talking about his new book just out called The Patient's Playbook, about how to get the best possible medical care. We're going to take a break right here, and we'll continue our conversation when we come back. I'm Laurie Mack, in for Faith Middleton. This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Laurie Mack, in for Faith. And we're talking today with Leslie Michelson. He's an advocate for patient education. And we're talking today about his new book called The Patient's Playbook, How to Save Your Life and the Lives of Those You Love. It's a guide to getting the best medical care possible and navigating your way through the healthcare delivery system. Leslie, do our interactions with our doctors and hospitals affect our treatment?
Yes. The interactions with your physicians dramatically dramatically affect your treatment. And physicians today are under so much pressure. They're under pressure to treat patients in shorter periods of time, to contain costs, yet to have billable experiences. They have regulatory constraints. Nurses are under constraints. The system just doesn't have the time and the resources necessary to provide the care that the caring physicians and nurses want to. And that's why I'm excited about this huge reservoir of energy and talent called 300 million Americans who can assert themselves. Let me give you an example. If you go online, if you've got the skills to plan a vacation, select a school for a child, make an investment, buy a car, rent an apartment, all those things that people do regularly today with much more information than they had in the pre-internet era, you can become a much more informed consumer about your medical issues. I can give you an example. We had a patient who had a tough breast cancer. Breast cancer is such a terrifying disease. And this is a patient who had a very aggressive presentation of it. And we were able to help her go online using a site called ExpertScape, which can give you very quickly the identities of the preeminent physicians in every particular specialty, to find the experts in the world with the most experience and capability to treat her disease. And when she went to see them, they dramatically changed the kind of care that she's getting, and she's doing terrifically well right now.
You have other websites that you recommend for research as well, but what's the first step in getting our records together, and how should they be organized?
Well, all of your medical records are your property. Under law, they belong to you, and every physician and every hospital that's ever treated you has an obligation to produce your medical records to you. So you can go online very easily and download a HIPAA form that will enable you to collect your medical records, fill it out, fax it in, mail it in to whoever your providers are, and within a relatively brief period of time, you'll have your medical records. And you can then organize them, because particularly if you've got a tough medical condition, you'll have ring binders full of them. Create a medical summary. Put it on top, 3 to 5 pages. Summarize the diseases you have, the medications you're on, the allergies, what the treatments have been. And that, if you bring that document into your physicians, they will see you as a different kind of patient. They'll see you as an active participant with them, as a partner in getting you the best outcome. The first case in the book that we talk about, Catherine, is someone who was told that she had this terrible diagnosis of Churg-Strauss syndrome. And we followed these rules and have gotten her to a much better place. She collected all of her medical records. We summarized them with her. We went online and simply Googled the words Churg-Strauss, which is a rare condition that in which your body starts to attack your own organs. And it's very painful and, frankly, ultimately fatal. And we found the Churg-Strauss Association. We then clicked on the medical advisory board there, and we saw that there was a person by the name of Michael Wexler as the head of it. We Googled him. We found out he was at an institution named Harvard. He's now at National Jewish in Denver. And then we went to ExpertScape and found out that he was the most prolific author on this disease. So it sounded like a fit. We emailed him. We asked him if he could get involved. We sent him the 4-inch thick ring binder and the summary. And he went right through it, and he was engaged in helping figure out a better treatment path for Catherine. And he determined that she didn't have Churg-Strauss to begin with.
Wow.
So we can do it, and I'm not saying it's the easiest thing in the world, but I am saying it's the most important thing, particularly if you have a tough medical issue.
How far back, and I'm sure the answer is going to be that it's different for everybody, but how far back should you go when you're collecting your records?
You're right. How far back you need to go depends on what's going on. If you've been healthy for 25 or 30 years and you're a 40-year-old person who's had no medical issues, if you go back 5 or 10 years, that's going to be plenty. But if you do have a set of symptoms that no one's been able to figure out or a diagnosis that happened some years ago, you should be sure to collect all of the medical records that relate to that situation. We have a patient right now who was in a hot tub in Mexico and developed some kind of infection about 18 months ago, and since then has been just in miserable pain. And it was important for us to get all of the medical records, you know, going back to that particular day. We didn't need to know what happened when she was 12 years old. So use your judgment and collect the information that's going to be most pertinent to what's going on.
You also got a view from some respected doctors on what patients should look for. What did you discover?
You know, what they will tell you is, particularly when it comes to complicated issues and rarely occurring issues, it's so important for patients to go to physicians who have the exact experience and expertise for whatever it is that ails them. Because there's nothing more complex than human biology. There's no realm of knowledge advancing more rapidly than biomedical research. So even if you're the smartest, hardest working, and most dedicated physician, it's almost impossible to be an expert in many different things. So one of the physicians I interviewed was Dr. Rob Udelsman, the chairman of surgery at Yale New Haven. And he's a terrific guy. And I asked him, what makes a good surgeon? And he said the same thing that you'd ask about what makes a good musician. It's practice, 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 and then focus, 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 and practice, practice, practice some more. So I then went to one of the preeminent musicians in the world, Martin Chalfont, who's the concertmaster at the LA Philharmonic. And I said, Martin, how do you prepare for a concert? And he said, I spend, you know, 6 weeks to 6 months preparing every little thing. That's what you want from your surgeons. That's what you want from your experts, people who have deep experience, so they will have seen more of the complexities and they'll know how to manage them.
Are there things that we can do right now to be better prepared?
Absolutely. Each and every person who's hearing me right now can do very specific things that are entirely in their control. First, prepare and document your family medical history. We're learning much more about how important heredity and genes are to disease. Sit down, particularly with your elderly relatives, and find out what really happened to the people who had passed away, and find out what their health is, and write it all up. It'll be a service to all of your family. Second, collect all of your medical records, organize them, digitize them, put together a summary, because that way you'll know no matter what happens to you, you've got the ability to record all that. And the third thing is have, as we discussed earlier, a deep and enduring relationship with a primary care physician. And the fourth thing is think about the support team that you'd want to put in place in the event that you personally develop or someone you love develops a serious medical issue. I believe when that circumstance occurs, you need to have a quarterback or you need to have a team of quarterbacks supporting you.
I'm talking with Leslie Michelson. He's an advocate for patient education, and we're talking about his new book just out called The Patient's Playbook. It's about how to get the best possible medical care. I want to get into how to develop a support team. But before we do, you suggested having your information, your medical information, digitized. And you mentioned getting a USB card. Can you explain what this is and how it works?
Sure. You know, you can go online and for $5 or $10 get a USB card that you can plug into your computer and download files into. And if you're technically not savvy, you really don't need to do that. You can just print stuff out on paper. But I carry in my wallet everywhere I go a USB card that's sort of about the size of a, sort of a sticks out of a thing about the size of a credit card. It's always in my wallet with my other credit cards. And it has all my medical records. It has emergency contact information. It has the couple of medications I'm on, the significant surgeries I have, the diagnoses, my allergies, my medical insurance information, and who to call in the event of emergency. Because if the worst event happens and I'm on a business trip in London and I don't look the right way and I get hit by that taxi, the first thing that the EMT experts know to do is find out who is this guy. Go into his wallet and they'll see that card. So they'll know what blood type I have, they'll know my medical history, and they'll know who to call to make sure I'm getting taken care of. I sleep better at night knowing that I have that.
So let's get into developing a support team. You point out in the book that doctors are busy and the onus is on the patient to coordinate their care. You say no one's managing and sharing your medical records, procuring expert opinions about your specific symptoms, and distributing the latest evidence-based science about your illness to the team. And most important, you say, no one is ensuring that all your caregivers are moving in a coordinated way toward the same goal. It used to be the primary care physician who played that role. So you say we should think about one or two people that we're close to that we could reliably turn to for help. And I'm guessing you've seen some cases where that wasn't quite as easy as you might think.
Yeah, I think it's so important when you're battling a tough illness, when you're feeling vulnerable, when you're going to perhaps have surgery, might have some powerful drugs that have side effects that leave you a little loopy or a little tired, and you're emotionally compromised, you're not going to be at the top of the game and able to become your own advocate. So what I've seen, and it's been frankly one of the most joyous and heartening things that I've ever been able to do in my life, is I've served as that advocate for thousands of people, and I know the role that needs to get played. And sometimes you can find one person to play all those roles, and sometimes it's several. But let me tell you what the roles are. You'll need somebody to provide clinical support, emotional support, intellectual support, and logistical support. Those are the four realms. And let me just give you a couple of examples of the kinds of people that you might think about in your life who you could line up to support you. So for the clinical support, that's got to be a person who's going to go online, who's going to read the research reports, help you find the best physicians and understand what's going on. And the right person for that is that compulsive researcher in your life, that person in college who's in the library all the time, the friend who knows how to find that airline flight to the city you want to go vacation in. That's, you know, the cheapest fare anybody's ever found. The person who you want to provide emotional support is that friend or loved one who's been with you a long time, so that when you call and you say hello, they can tell from the timbre in your voice that there's something wrong. They're so wired into you emotionally that they're on your wavelength, and that's the person who you want to call and say, listen, you know, if I get diagnosed with something tough, I know I'm going to need emotional support, and you've been so good at doing that for me. You know, when I had this other problem or whatever it might be, I'm wondering if I'd be able to count on you if that fateful day ever comes. And I know people are reluctant to ask friends and loved ones to support them in these ways, but I'll tell you from decades of personal experience, there are very few things that you can do in life that would provide greater satisfaction, create deeper or more meaningful or longer interpersonal relationships. I was on the phone the other day with a woman who was telling me that a friend of hers had a tough breast cancer, had brought in four of her friends to serve the exact roles that I'm talking about. And most of them didn't know one another because they were friends from different walks of life for her. And they supported her for a couple years. They became very close to one another. And they sadly lost their dear friend because she had a tough, tough case. But they get together periodically to remember her, to mourn her, and to support one another.
That's a great story.
It ends up being a very, very beautiful thing.
I have to say, that sounds like a very difficult conversation to have. It seems like such a burden, and you don't really even know what you're asking if you haven't been diagnosed yet.
Yeah, and sometimes it makes sense to try and set it up in advance, and other times maybe not, depending on who you are and how you approach things. But one way to do it, and we, you know, I give some examples of this, is if you've seen a friend of yours, you know, a shared friend or relative who went through a tough medical issue, to call somebody and say, you know, it was so difficult when Mary, you know, had that terrible colon cancer, and there was so much chaos and there wasn't organization, and I really felt like we kind of let her down and didn't do everything we could have for her, and I'd hoped that if I ever have something like that, that you'll be there to help me in a more structured way so we can go forward together.
For some people, their quarterback is going to be their spouse, which I realize can be very tricky. Can you talk more about spouses also fulfilling the role of patient advocate?
Spouses can do it. In fact, I've done it for my spouse, and she's done it for me. Spouses can definitely discharge that role, but I think it's important to have an explicit conversation that the role is actually more and more specific than just being a devoted and loving spouse. It requires doing research. It requires logistical management. It requires coordination across physicians. And done right, I think it can dramatically strengthen any relationship and deepen the bonds between any two people.
I want to go back for just a second. You have a section in the book that deals specifically with finding specialists. Can we talk a little more about that process?
There's a treasure trove of information available now on physicians and how they practice, what they focus on, and what their results are. But it's a tragic treasure trove because most people don't know to access it and don't realize how important it can be. So particularly, again, if you have a significant medical issue, the first place to start is to go to the websites of the major hospitals in the nearest major city. And those websites will tell you who the physicians are. They'll tell you about the areas that they focus on, and you'll get a sense of the level of experience they have. You can also call into the hospitals. You know, we make a practice of calling into the chairman of surgery, the chairman of medicine, and saying, you know, we've got a patient in your community who's got a badly torn rotator cuff. Who's your best shoulder expert? We'd like to set up an appointment. And they'll make a referral to you, and it will be helpful. But it's also important to find out what's known about that physician. Are they board certified? Are there any administrative issues or lawsuits pending against them that might raise a question as to how well they're functioning? And that information is readily available now, and we give guidance in the book as to where to find that.
You recommend interviewing specialists before treatment or surgery, and of course the questions asked will be unique to the patient, but you say there are four must-asks.
Right. You need to ask, you know, what is your experience with respect to this condition? Are you confident in my diagnosis, and how do we know that that's right? Why does it need to be treated, and when does it need to be treated? And lastly, are there any other less invasive interventions that I can use?
If you're just joining us, my guest is Leslie Michelson. He spent 30 years in the healthcare business. He's the CEO of Private Health Management and is the author of The Patient's Playbook. It's a guide to getting the best medical care available. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll get into some of the common mistakes people make in the first 24 hours of a medical emergency and when to question a diagnosis. I'm Lori Mack, sitting in today for Faith Middleton. We'll be right back. This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack, in for Faith. We're talking today with Leslie Michelson. He's the author of The Patient's Playbook, How to Save Your Life and the Lives of Those You Love. It's a guide that offers techniques to getting the best medical care and how to navigate our healthcare system. Leslie, you asked physicians if there were good and bad ways to reach out to them. What did you find out?
You know, physicians don't like patients to come to them with a presumption. They're respected professionals, and you need to treat them with respect. So, you know, one of the physicians we interviewed said it very poignantly, which is, and I think it was Phil Meese, which is, I'm happy to get an email from someone with information and get on a phone and do a virtual consultation, provided that I have enough information to render judgment and be helpful. But please, don't try and get me to give you significant advice without giving me all the information and giving me an opportunity to ask the questions that I need to make sure that I can exercise my judgment properly. A lot of the mistakes, we started the conversation earlier, there's so many mistakes that get made in medicine that are preventable. A lot of those are because the necessary information has not been conveyed to the physicians with the clarity and specificity they need to exercise their judgment at the highest level.
Let's get into emergency room visits. There's a section called Emergency Room 101. where you talk about common mistakes people make in the first 24 hours of a medical emergency. There's a lot of interesting information here, some I never imagined I needed to know.
Sure. You know, one of them is illustrated by a story we tell of Tracy, who's a woman in Chicago who fell down in her shower, was unconscious, came to, and when she did, called her loving sister rather than 911, and was driven by her sister some hours later to an emergency room. So she made two mistakes early on. The first was, given the condition that she was in, she probably should have called 911. She was fortunate that that delay didn't cost her anything, but it very well could have. And second, they ended up in the wrong emergency room because that hospital did not have the expertise that she needed. So you can, you need to understand when you have to call 911, when you should be going to an urgent care clinic, when you should be calling your primary care physician. And there's a lot of guidance as to when that is. The older, the more frail the patient, the other complications, the more likely that you pull up the phone and call 911. If the injury seems to be minor, if it's on an arm or a leg rather than on the torso or the head, you can probably be a little less cautious about it and go to an urgent care clinic. So the other things that are important in the mistakes that are made in an emergency situation, in addition to not calling 911 when you should, being at the wrong emergency room, is not being communicative with the physicians. It's, there's literature which shows a stunning statistic that on average in an emergency room context, when patients are asked to describe what happened, they're interrupted in 12 seconds. That's a really quick period of time because emergency rooms are chaotic places where people don't have time. So you need to be assertive and communicative and make sure that the physicians and nurses who are trying to take care of you and potentially hundreds of other people know all the information that you think is important for them to figure out what's going on. And then the last piece is particularly, and I know this is hard, when you've had a medical emergency, you've broken your leg, you've been hit by a car, maybe you've had a minor stroke or something, you have to remember that you're in charge. You need to make sure that the physicians who are treating you understand what's happened, are at the top of their game, and are coordinated, and that you're coordinating with them, with the other physicians who are taking care of you. That's a responsibility that if you can't discharge, you need to have your healthcare quarterback discharge for you.
What would you do in the case of an emergency where a doctor says, you don't have time to wait, we need to operate today?
Well, I would make sure that I understood and interrogated that physician on exactly what's going on and exercised my judgment on it. So, for example, if there's blood gushing, if the pain is getting worse and not better, and it feels to you like it's an emergency that has that degree of acuity, well, then it's probably right. But there's almost always time. It's very rare that there isn't time to at least get in touch with your primary care physician and get another perspective on it. Because if you have a procedure that isn't necessary, the consequences of that in many cases can be quite devastating. There's an executive that we've worked with who's a financial investor who had a couple years of back pain that just wasn't going away. It was gnarly. It would go away and it would come back the way many people do. And he got so frustrated and he had a specific physician who said, let's just operate on this thing and see if we can just get it fixed. And this guy in his gut knew that that wasn't the right intervention, but he was so fatigued and so frustrated that he went forward with it. And the problem is, it wasn't a surgery that he needed, it didn't address the problem that he had, and his situation for the years since that surgery has been much worse than it was before. So every surgical intervention is not without consequence and is something that really should be considered very thoughtfully and very carefully.
You had your own serious medical condition and had to take your own advice. Can you talk a little about what happened there and what you learned from it?
Yeah. So I know everything that goes wrong in the healthcare system. So I can be a really nervous Nelly when it comes to being a patient. And some years ago, as I tell in the book, I was diagnosed with something called primary hyperparathyroidism, in which you have these glands in your neck that are resulting in you having too much calcium in your blood. And that can be kind of a devastating situation. And it became very clear to me that I needed surgery for the condition to get the offending glands removed from my body. But I was really worried about it because I spend a lot of my life talking, and one of the complications of that surgery can be interference with the vocal cords. So I decided I would become my own patient. I did my own research. I found online the physician who is the preeminent expert in the diagnosis of this condition, a Dr. John Belazikian in New York. I went to see him. He confirmed the diagnosis. He confirmed that surgery was necessary, so I knew I was in good shape on that. And I felt much better with the confirmation of both. And then the question was, who's the best surgeon in the country? And he's a very experienced guy, and he said, you know, the guy who I think is the best is Dr. Rob Uhlesman at Yale. So I called his office. I made an appointment. And after I did research, and I learned that he had improved the entire surgical technique because he figured out how to do what's called intraoperative testing during the surgery on certain parameters in the body to know whether he had succeeded in getting all of the bad glands out of the body. And I went to see him, and it turned out he was a terrific surgeon, and I had the rarest presentation of this disease. Only 2-3% of all patients had the presentation I had, and I think had I gone to most any other surgeon in the country, I would have had to go back for another surgery, which would have dramatically increased the probability that I would have had complications. So I, if you would, followed my own medicine, and it really paid off. I had one surgery. I'm cured.
What about questioning a diagnosis? When should you question your diagnosis?
You know, this will sound harsh, but all of the time.
And this is where second opinions come in, which you say is a common phrase. And you go on to explain that it's not just another opinion that we need. It's the right opinion.
Yeah. So everything starts with the diagnosis. If the diagnosis is inaccurate or incomplete or delayed, then everything that follows it is almost necessarily wrong. So for cancer in particular, it's extremely important, if not essential, to have the tissue that's typically used, the biopsy tissue for diagnosing the cancer, reread independently by pathologists with expertise in precisely that cancer. We have a case, you know, I've got a lot of these cases that disturb. We have a case a couple of years ago, a 40-odd-year-old daughter of one of the wealthiest and most well-known families in America. I obviously can never use anyone's names, who was treated at a major center for a cancer, and she'd been treated for 6 months, and they brought us in when the treatment wasn't working and she was having terrible side effects. And we realized that they had not had a second set of eyes on that biopsy tissue. So we sent it out to another major cancer center, and they diagnosed it as a different cancer. We thought, whoo, that's a serious problem. We sent it out to yet a third center, and they came back with the same conclusion as the second center. So it turned out that this poor woman had been treated for 6 months with chemotherapy for a cancer for which that chemo is totally ineffective, even though she had all the side effects of the chemo. And by that point, it was really too late to save her life.
Wow.
So if you look at the literature, you know, Dr. Scardino says on the order of 1-2% of all the cases that come into Memorial Sloan Kettering, having been diagnosed with cancer, don't have cancer. That's 15,000 people nationally a year. And at MD Anderson in Houston, they say that about 20% of the patients that come in there, when they look at it very carefully, actually have a meaningful difference in what the diagnosis is that affects treatment. So in cancer, in back disease, in everything, it's just so important to get the diagnosis right. You know, the carpenters taught us. Everybody who's a carpenter knows the old the old saying within carpentry, measure twice, cut once. And that's just for a 2x4. Well, what you're talking about here is your body, your life, your well-being. It makes sense to always get second opinions by experts, so what we call our expert opinions on the diagnostic front.
When it comes to getting a second opinion on a pathology report, how complicated is it to get a second opinion? Where do you start?
You know, it's so much easier than everyone appreciates. So the tissue that a physician has taken out of you in a biopsy is by law kept by the pathologists at the hospital or the center. They're required to do that. And all you need to do is request that the tissue be sent to another pathologist to look at it. So you can just call another major institution, find out if they've got a pathologist with expertise in breast cancer, lung cancer, brain cancer, whatever it is that you might have, and ask them if they'll do a second read, and they will. And so there's absolutely no risk to the patient because the tissue's out. It's just sitting in a freezer someplace. And, or it's or not even, it's just sitting in room temperature. And the cost to do a second read is maybe a couple of $100. And I know that can be a lot of money to a lot of people, but a lot of the insurance companies will pay for that. And it's so small relative to the total cost for the treatment of a cancer. And it's so important because everything that follows from that interpretation has to be done right.
I know people often feel awkward about telling their doctor that they'd like to get another opinion. And you talk to doctors about this. How do they feel when they hear the words, I'd like another opinion?
You know, most every doctor that you want to see recognizes that it's called practicing medicine because there's a lot of art in it. It's extremely complex and it's extremely important. And the physicians who I respect welcome the judgment and the input of others. You know, one of the things that Dr. Arling in the book suggests is if you're uncomfortable about it, and he's a primary care physician in Washington, D.C., he says, look, if you as a patient are uncomfortable with that, just tell him that I made the request. That'll take care of it. Mm-hmm. And most primary care physicians will stand up for that. But I really mean if you have a physician who resists your desire to get a second opinion, that's good reason to think about getting a different physician.
Agreed. The book is full of very helpful information. Leslie, if there was one message that you'd like people to take away from this conversation today, what would it be?
I guess the one thing is I realize, you know, how overwhelming the healthcare delivery system can be, especially if you're sick and you're feeling vulnerable. But during the past 3 decades, I've helped thousands of people assert themselves, and I've seen that they've gotten much better medical care. So I wrote the book to provide you and everyone with the resources, the advice, and the tools that you need to summon your courage and to develop your competence as a better healthcare consumer. I know you can do it, even though it can be intimidating. I know everyone can do it. And when you do, you'll feel more confident, you'll get better medical care, and you and your loved ones will lead longer and healthier lives.
The book is called The Patient's Playbook, How to Save Your Life and the Lives of Those You Love, by my guest, Leslie Michelson. Leslie, thank you for coming on the show.
Lori, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
You can find out more about the book and Leslie Michelson at WNPR.org. I'm Lori Mack, in for Faith Middleton. Thanks for listening.